From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Today, a legislative Republican from southeastern Wisconsin shares her hopes for a new session, including addressing public safety and high prices.
Everything's more expensive because of inflation, and people are struggling to make ends meet when their money is just not being able to purchase as much as they did a year or 2 years ago. So a lot of people were feeling the pinch.
We'll tell you how to properly dispose of your Christmas tree if you still have it. Plus, we'll learn how to care for birds this winter.
Keeping those feeders out doesn't keep the birds there longer. It just helps support them. So if they do choose to be there longer, or if they decided that they don't want to migrate, they'll still have those resources and that energy to keep going through the winter.
All that's coming up on Lake Effect, but first, here are today's headlines. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Thanks for joining us today. It's a new two-year session in the state capitol, and WUWM is checking in with legislators about their goals for this term. Last week, WUWM's Mayon Silver spoke with Democratic Representative and Assembly Minority Leader Greta Neubauer. Today, you'll hear Mayon's conversation with Jesse Rodriguez, a legislative Republican from southeastern Wisconsin, who's on the Joint Finance Committee. She represents the 21st Assembly District, which includes some of southern Milwaukee, Oak Creek, and a bit of Greenfield. Representative Rodriguez shares with Mayan what she's been hearing when door-knocking in her district and how she and other Republicans in the legislature plan to respond.
What were you hearing from constituents, and what are your big priorities going forward for this session?
Yeah, I think two major themes that I heard at the doors was ways that we can help people with the fact that everything's more expensive because of inflation, and people are struggling to make ends meet when their money is just not being able to purchase as much as they did a year or 2 years ago. So a lot of people were feeling the pinch that, you know, milk was costing more, just the essential things, milk, eggs, bread, all these things. So trying to find ways to be able to help them in a time when people are feeling the pinch was the biggest thing that I heard at the doors. The second thing that I heard at the doors was public safety. People are concerned with reckless driving, and so they're, you know, wanting us to see if we could do more to address that issue. I heard it more in the city of Milwaukee than I did in Oak Creek, but even in Oak Creek, people were very much concerned about that issue.
Okay, so back to the economic concerns of the constituents. You are on the very powerful Joint Finance Committee, which actually deals with the budget process in Wisconsin. What are you expecting for that?
This will be my third term on the committee. I was fortunate that my leader reappointed me to the committee. And so some of the things that we did last session are probably some of the things we're going to look to see if we could get support from the members, but also hopefully the governor. So some of the things that we did do last session to try to help people when everyone was concerned about the cost of goods was providing tax reductions. And so that was in the form of income tax reduction, property tax reduction last session, and also helping the elderly by introducing a bill, which is essentially the retirement tax exemption. So those are three pieces of tax reductions that we proposed last session in the budget. Governor Evers, unfortunately, did not support that. And so he ended up vetoing $3.5 billion in income tax reductions that we were proposing in the budget, and ultimately that resulted in about $175 million tax cut for individuals. So it was a partial veto. So there was still some reductions in income tax, but just not as deep as we wanted to. And the other item that was so important to a lot of the retirees was the retirement tax exemption. I heard that was by far the number one issue that I heard from people who were retired. They were surprised that the governor did not support it last session. And so hopefully we can look at these proposals and maybe try to reintroduce it this next session. But we will have to, talk to the other members and get feedback and see if people are still wanting to do that. After all, we've seen that the governor has vetoed 3 times an income tax reduction. So I don't know if people are going to be willing to do this again and hope that he will support it. I don't know. But we've done retirement exemption once. And so maybe this is maybe one that maybe he can come around and hopefully support this next time around if we decide to do that.
You're tuned into Lake Effect. This is WEWM's Mayan Silver speaking with GOP State Representative Jesse Rodriguez of Oak Creek. So, Representative Rodriguez, you were just talking about tax cuts. Evers had signed, like you mentioned, some GOP-backed income tax cuts, but he's vetoed others because he says they would leave the state unable to do things like fund education, healthcare, safety, aid to local government. I have 2 questions about the tax cuts. So I think Evers also says that he wants middle-class tax cuts or tax cuts for people making under a certain amount of money and not necessarily for people that are more well-off. But also, how much do you think tax cuts could affect the average Wisconsinite? And what are the other priorities that you have beyond tax cuts economically?
Sure. I think, I know that the governor's claimed that he had concerns with being able to fund other things, but we were able to approve that in spite of the income tax cuts that we were providing, that we were also going to be able to fund other areas that he mentioned, like local governments. And actually, we proposed the shared revenue proposal that he ultimately signed and became Act 12, which is essentially providing more funding for local governments. It was a huge win for everyone. I was a co-sponsor of that bill with Representative Kurtz. So that's a huge win for all of our communities. And it's still, being able to get to be able to help our locals, but still be able to provide tax cut. We did that. Unfortunately, he did not see that. As a result of that, we're sitting in with about over $2 billion in revenues that were left over from his veto. So, a lot of people were very much unhappy to know that we are sitting on money in our coffers, but that was because the governor chose to veto those proposals that was going to help families. And that is, our tax proposal was meant to go to middle-class families. So there, it wasn't meant to go to the people who can afford, inflation. It was meant to help everyone, middle-class families, working families, who were struggling to pay for everyday needs and essentials.
In addition to tax cuts, what are the GOP priorities this year when it comes to, funding basically priorities? What do Republicans want to do with that money and with other money that the state has available to it?
Sure. I mean, we are still early in the process. Obviously, we want to see what the governor proposes. So we're looking forward to seeing what he introduces once he delivers his budget address in February. So looking forward to seeing what his priorities are going to be. And so we really haven't had a lot of discussion on, what we want to do this next legislative session. With respect to the budget, I just say that these are things that people have told me in my district are, finding ways to help them to address their, the rising cost of everyday goods. And so we're going to look to see if there are ways that we can do that. And obviously, we've seen that the governor hasn't been willing to do certain things in the past. So I don't know if that's something we're going to propose again. So we'll see.
So I did talk to Greta Neubauer. She's the Assembly Minority Leader, and she told me that her caucus has priorities that are somewhat similar to Republicans in the sense that you guys have all been knocking on the same doors, talking to the same voters for the most part, And she said there are 2 priorities that rise to the top for them. The first is addressing costs for working families. There's also education, and that has to do with the fact that a lot of counties have gone to referendum municipalities in the past several years to keep up with their operations. And so I was wondering if you see any possibility for bipartisanship on some of these issues.
I don't know. I mean, I think that's early in the disc. We haven't really, as a caucus, we haven't really discussed a lot of these issues. It's been more of a, you know, overarching theme, and that is, you know, try to address, like I said, the cost for everyday middle class families, and also obviously public safety. So those are, I know that those are some overarching themes that most people in the caucus have said that they have heard from their constituents, but we haven't really talked into in further detail on the items that the rest of the members would be supportive of.
And of course, there are new maps in the legislature that this was the first time people were elected under those, and some of the districts are a lot more competitive now. Do you feel that in the environment in the legislature, that people are maybe more considerate of people with different viewpoints, talking to others, talking to constituents? Has there been any sort of change in tenor in the legislature so far in these first couple weeks?
I mean, we're all getting to know each other. I mean, it's a different legislative body than I served on 2 years ago. I know that on the other side of the other Dem aisle, they have 10, they're increased their numbers by 10 individuals, but they have about over 20 new members in their caucus. So they have a lot of new members in their caucus. There's less of them on our end. So I think right now, you know, we're all trying to get to know each other. It's kind of like, you know, starting school, either first grade or sixth grade, where, you know, you kind of know some people, but some people, there's a lot of people you don't know, and so you're, you know, getting to know everyone and seeing if there's any ways that you can connect and things that, you know, you can work on together.
And finally, if there was anything that you could tell people to sort of demystify the legislative experience or process, what would you tell them about it?
Demystify it. That's an interesting question. I would say, you know what, I tell people, you know, if you have any doubts or concerns of anything related to state government, call my office, call, you know, go onto the legislative website and find out who your representative or your senator is, and call them and share your thoughts about certain issues that are important to them. I think that is so valuable. I've had people who've contacted the office because they maybe had applied for unemployment and they weren't getting responses. They were getting a runaround or whatever, and they've called my office and they say, I don't know what to do. And we say, well, guess what? I think we can connect you to someone who could possibly help you. So, you know, those are the things that I think a lot of people don't realize that they can do, that you know, we have state agencies, and sometimes when people struggle to get connected to their state agencies, they can contact our office and we can be a resource to them to be able to help them get the help that they need.
All right. Legislator Jesse Rodriguez, thank you for speaking with me.
Thank you, Maya.
Jesse Rodriguez is a Republican representative for the 21st Assembly District. She spoke with WUWM's Mayon Silver. You can hear Mayan's conversation with Democratic Assembly Minority Leader Greta Neubauer at WUWM.com. With a new year, often comes resolutions. But it doesn't have to be about your physical health. Instead, you could focus on your financial health. Author and financial educator Berna Anat, a self-described financial hype woman and rich auntie in training, talks with WUWM's Jimmy Gutierrez about how to approach refocusing on your finances this new year.
A lot of your work, like you said, you're focused on first-gen folks, people of color, people that just haven't grown up with or had the option of generational wealth and what that could mean to for safety and all these things. And then thinking of money that way, it's not just money, right? It's shame, it's trauma. This is a big question, but what are some of the hangups you see in the way that we kind of have relationships with money that could unstick us from a debt journey or help us on our way through a debt journey?
Oh, for sure. That's a great question. I will say straight up that everybody in the club has shame. Everybody in the club has shame about money to some degree, to some flavor, because for so many BIPOC families, for second gen families, immigrant families, the kind of resounding theme is, oh, we don't talk about money. Most of the people I work with come from families where they either didn't talk about money at all, or the ways that money was talked about was already preloaded with shame and guilt or not enoughness. And to be clear, these things are not just like magical feelings that like came down from above, like our ancestors just sort of gave us this baggage. This is stuff set up systemically. You know, a lot of, again, immigrant, first-gen BIPOC families, in their histories or even in their immediate lineage, they felt the actual effects of being underpaid. Like any kind of wealth-building tactics are totally kind of out of reach for them. Getting the information gatekept, actual like colonization, pillaging of their wealth, however many generations back. From there, we're taught these messages of shame, of because you don't have enough, that's your fault. I'm going to be a little bit of like a bootleg, completely unlicensed mental health person because I love that stuff.
Okay. We're here for it.
Just like know that this is like incredibly unlicensed words. But I am going through my own therapy journey and understanding that things, for example, in like our personal relationships and romantic relationships, there are things that we've learned from our parents and our caregivers that we carry on into our adult relationships. Same exact thing for our money brains. There are things that we learn from our caregivers and the world around us that we bring into our adult financial behaviors. So I just really want to invite a lot of, again, grace, space, understanding it's not easy to be the person kind of in between generations trying to figure it out and stop the cycle, because it's a big ask. It's a big lift.
So I want to play a little game with you. I mined some questions from folks around Milwaukee. And when I told them I was talking to you, I was just like, do you have anything to ask your future rich auntie? What would you like her to give you advice on? So would you be up to answer some of their questions?
Oh, 100%. I'm always trying to practice my future auntie like self. So let's go.
Okay, perfect. So the first one, can I trust Google to teach me how to budget because my rent is high? How much should I be spending and saving?
Great question. It's really common now to just turn to the Googles or the ChatGPTs and be like, help, fix it for me, please. I would trust Google to a certain degree in that it might give you the general information, like the sort of general advice of budgeting when your expenses are super high. This general advice you might find through the Googles is the 50-30-20 rule. And so that's kind of been the party line for many, many years. That rule says your budget, I'm putting lots of air quotes around things, that if you're budgeting your money, 50% of your money, quote unquote, should go to your expenses. These are your needs. I call it my come get me bills, because if I don't pay these things, someone's going to come get me. Someone's going to be like, I need that light bill. I need that, you know, health insurance bill. Your rent is supposed to fit in that 50%. This is where I lose a lot of people already. They're like, 50, what?
Yeah. Supposed to be rent 50%? In which year?
Exactly. Yeah. Which decade? Whom's ancestors is paying 50%? And then 30% of your money, quote unquote, should go towards your wants, you know, entertainment and fun and things you don't necessarily need for survival. And then that last 20%, quote unquote, should go towards your financial goals. So that's savings, that's putting extra down on debt, investing extra for retirement and things like that. Now, if you're a person that's like, my rent is high and it will not fit inside of that 50%, you got to be able to stretch it and flex it to what works for you. The problem with the 50-30-20 rule is that it makes people read the majority of us in major cities be like, oh my God, I'm broken. Something's wrong with me. But please know that when I was on like an aggressive debt payoff journey, I would say my like that 20% became like 40%. I had to go all the way down on my like regular expenses. And then before that, my 50% was actually 70%. A lot of people see the 50-30-20 rule and they're like, oh, well, budgeting's not for me. I don't fit in there. It's really about customizing it to where your life actually is and giving yourself a lot of time to see where your percentages fall, knowing that budgeting is an exercise that you should be returning to regularly and like messing with regularly. My percentages never stay in one place. They always flex according to where I live, what I'm doing, what my priorities are. It's a good place to start, but be gentle with yourself.
I appreciate the gentle approach, which kind of gets into another question I heard was the idea of not internalizing being a moral failure for living paycheck to paycheck. Even trying to think about money or how to save when someone's in survival mode.
Oh my gosh. Okay. Maybe it's because I woke up feeling spicy today, but I immediately feel defensive for this person that might feel like they are a moral failure for having debt. Now that I think it's because we tapped into this like auntie persona, I immediately feel very defensive for this person in that not only are you not a moral failure for having debt, because as I said before, debt is a tool that us living in this monopoly version of capitalism, we have had to leverage. We have been forced to leverage in a lot of ways because that is how the system is set up. It is set up for us to have to choose debt and then have to pay a lot for that debt because of interest rates, be in debt for a long time, actually pay way more out of our nose because we had to take that debt. And also the system itself is set up so that you feel bad for having chosen the only thing that was available to you. I'm feeling anti-defensive because I'm like, no, you're beating yourself up over something that was never meant for you to win in the first place. So I want to give this person a hug and I want to get out in front of them between like them and the shame of capitalism and tell them that like, you are doing your best to survive. You're doing your best with the tools that you're being given. And by the way, the tools suck and they're not meant for you to thrive. So do what you can to shower the moral shame off because these debt companies absolutely are using no kind of moral compass to deal with you. It's not worth the energy.
Last question. And I got a lot of work questions too, but this comes from people who feel like they're either starting a job or they've left a lot of money on the table when they started a job because they didn't know how to ask for a raise. Please teach us how to ask for a raise.
Ooh, okay. Goodness. I will say I am not necessarily a negotiation queen. I'm thinking about one person who is an incredible resource. Their name is Mandy Woodruff, and they are the like hopping jobs negotiation queen. But one thing I learned from Mandy is when you are negotiating, for example, inside of a job and you're trying to get a higher wage for a job you already have, or you're like want a promotion, something I learned from Mandy is that you want to make the case irresistible. So understanding that today you would like to ask for a raise in the future, put a sort of like goal date for yourself 6 months from now that you are going to be like officially asking for that raise in 6 months. Let your manager or whoever your bosses know, I'm going to be asking for this raise in 6 months. I'm looking to this for these reasons. And in 6 months, I'm going to give you a case as to why I deserve that. And then spend that period of time building up your case, basically creating as much of a paper trail of the impact you make in that company as possible. It's important to let your team know that you're going to be asking for that raise because then it gives them the time to sort of figure out the mechanics around that ask on the higher level while you build your case. You are like putting together data of like impact you have on the customers. You're putting together data on events that you threw and like how that helped the company's bottom line. You're putting together testimonials on customers who thought that you were like the best barista ever. And also checking in with your boss along those 6 months so that by the end of those 6 months, it doesn't feel like you're making a case to the boss. It feels like you and the boss are making a case to their boss. It's like the two of you are now on this like journey to make this right and get a yes to the person above them. Mm-hmm. Because it doesn't work great if it's like you versus your boss getting a raise because the boss also has somebody to answer to. If you help that boss make it easy to present you to somebody higher than them, that could see a lot of success.
I can imagine that a lot of people will hear this and wonder, how do I get my own Berna or where do I find you? Should they work with a financial planner? What would your advice be for where people should go if they're in the place where they can look for this kind of help?
Oh, you know what? I will say that January is an incredible time to really consider getting expert help. These days, I'm very anti like self-driven work, self-motivation. We need community. We need people to help us. And I would say the best place to start looking for a financial planner is a resource like XY Planning Network. You can go on, and what I love about XY Planning Network, you could find a certified financial planner that is fee-based and not commission-based, is my advice. And you can also filter for your life. You can filter for people at certain intersections of life. Maybe you are like mid-career and you're trying to start a family. Also, you are looking for someone in a specific ethnicity set and you want someone who understands like queer family building. You can filter for all of that in XY Planning Network and find a financial professional that understands your life. Because what we're seeing on the new dime side and helping people connect to financial professionals that they trust is it is a horrible experience to like have a sit down with a financial planner that doesn't get you and is like, why would you put aside that savings for your mom in the Philippines? Like that's, you know, that's not something that my family would do. So like, don't do it. Like, why would you think about caregiving for your family in the future? Why don't you have them do it themselves? It's an awful experience to get gaslit by a financial planner that doesn't get the specifics of your personal life. And so look for that and filter for that in something like XY Planning Network.
Berna, thank you so much for taking the time and sharing just, it was a lot, but just tidbits of your knowledge today. I appreciate it so much. Thank you for talking with me.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm happy to come on and financially auntie anytime.
Okay, cool.
Berna Anat is an author and financial educator. She spoke with WUWM's Jimmy Gutierrez. Did you know you can listen to Lake Effect as a podcast? Just search for Lake Effect wherever you get your podcast to download and listen to us on demand. Later in the show, we'll talk about environmentally friendly ways to approach the purchasing and disposal of holiday decorations. But first, we'll learn about the birds that stay in Wisconsin during the winter and how to help them survive. That's coming up next on Lake Effect on WUWM. You're listening to Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Most people can survive the winter weather by layering up and turning on the heater. But it's a little more complicated for birds. Lake Effect's Exgrit Nunez spoke with regional conservation specialist Toby Siegert at the Milwaukee County Zoo. He says winter is a great time to keep the backyard bird feeder stocked so you can help birds stay nourished through the season. He also discusses how the county zoo takes care of wild birds year-round.
I am so excited to be chatting with you today at the Milwaukee County Zoo. And you know, Toby, some people might not know this, but the zoo doesn't just care for its own animals. It also cares for wild birds. Can you tell me about the Wild Birds Program?
Yeah, for sure. The Society supports the Wild Birds Program. We do weekly point count surveys, so I'll go out with a bunch of volunteers and we go birding every Tuesday morning. We also do, in the wintertime, we'll do Project Feeder Watch. So we've got a bunch of different bird feeder stations throughout the zoo. So next time you're visiting the zoo, take a peek, see if you can find the feeders located around the walkways. But we're in charge of filling all of those feeders, and that helps support the birds in the winter months especially because they have trouble finding food that time of year. We also support a MODIS program, so we've got a MODIS tower on zoo grounds, which is pretty cool. It's this newer technology, so newer than bird banding, but they attach these little like chips to the back of a bird, and it allows us to track their migration, which is pretty cool.
Whoa, lots of different things. Yeah, so do you get to do that, the MODIS?
So I'm working towards hopefully getting to do that in the future. But right now we'll send staff down to Belize and they help deploy MODIS trackers down there with the hopes that those birds are then migrating back up to Wisconsin.
Wow.
Which is pretty cool. So.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So something that you'd mentioned, you said one way that the zoo cares for wild birds is by putting out plenty of feeders, but I was interested, with winter coming up, do you put feeders away? It seems like we don't.
No, so I actually keep the feeders out year-round, and you'll see that there'll be a lot of different species that'll come to the feeders. you'll notice that robins have been sticking around. Historically, you know, robins will migrate because it's all about food resources. But as, you know, climate change is impacted and food availability is still available for robins to eat, they'll stay around year-round. So you might actually see robins in the winter now. Same thing with, like, Canada geese. Those stick around year-round quite often. So keeping up those feeders does provide a lot of food for those birds. And they kind of become reliant almost on those feeders, too.
And I feel like one, like, myth, I guess you could call it, is if you do keep your bird feeders out, you're not making birds not migrate.
Correct.
Right?
Yeah. So if a bird wants to migrate, it'll migrate. its body will tell it that it's time to move on. Keeping those feeders out doesn't keep the birds there longer. It just helps support them. So if they do choose to be there longer, or if they decided that they don't want to migrate, they'll still have those resources and that energy to keep going through the winter.
Right. Thank you for clarifying that.
Yeah.
And so what type of bird feeders and feed do you recommend people keep out?
So in the winter, I recommend suet always, just because it is a higher fat content and a lot of birds really are looking for that higher fat content. I'll also put out in the winter black oil sunflower seed. It's what we put out here at the zoo as well. And then a lot of finch species really like the Niger seed. So we'll also be putting that out year round as well for them. And those all tend to have a higher fat content, which the birds really like. So.
Right. And another resource is, should we keep water out for birds throughout the winter?
Yeah. So that's another really, really valuable resource, especially in the cold weather, because there's not as much open water. And so keeping a heated bird bath is really, really helpful, especially in the winter as a lot of stuff starts to freeze, as temperatures start to drop. So you can also, like, if you have a metal bird bath or a plastic bird bath, they actually do even sell, like, heated bird bath inserts that you can put into an existing bird bath if you don't want to go out and buy, like, a new one. But they do also just sell heated bird baths. But, yeah, providing water is really, really important, too.
So what are the types of birds that tend to stick around for the wintertime?
We get a lot of cardinals. A lot of people love seeing cardinals. We also have a lot of chickadees. We'll get a lot of different finches. So we have goldfinches. Those tend to stick around year-round. They don't look as pretty and bright yellow this time of year. They're more drab and olive-colored, but they do stick around year-round. So if you're seeing birds and you're like, I don't know what that is, it might be a goldfinch that you're just not aware that it's a goldfinch. It looks a little different. We also get house finches this time of year, house sparrows, robins. They tend to stick around occasionally. You'll also see a lot of woodpeckers this time of year. So red-bellied woodpeckers, downy woodpeckers, hairy woodpeckers, they're all feeder favorites. So I tend to see them quite often at our suet feeders. They absolutely go bananas for suet. so, yeah, that's oftentimes what we'll see.
Wow, that's amazing. So where are some good type of places to place your feeder, like closer to trees or like, yeah, what kind of habitat or environment?
That's a very good question. So if you're putting them in your backyard or near any kind of building with a window, we tend to recommend that people have their feeder either less than 3 feet away from the window or greater than 10 feet away from the window. And that's just so that when birds are flying, if they happen to be flying the direction of your window, if it's less than 3 feet, they're not able to get enough momentum to hit and injure themselves. And if it's greater than 10 feet, they're less likely to smack into the window. But other than that, I mean, you can put them up just about anywhere. People will even spread, like, suet. They sell suet that you can spread onto trees and that kind of stuff. And woodpeckers will go crazy for it. You might attract some squirrels, too. but they like it, so.
And you mentioned that another way the zoo cares for wild birds is by doing weekly count surveys. What are you monitoring for when you're doing those?
Yeah, so we're kind of checking biodiversity. We go to 11 different stations throughout the zoo, and we stop for 5 minutes. I'll set a timer, and we basically sit there and look and listen for birds, and I'll record every single species that we've either seen or heard. Also, we'll run Merlin, which is a free app. If you don't already have it, I recommend it. It's a lot of fun. And we'll run it on all of our phones just in case there's something that we didn't hear. And I denote in my notes whether we saw, heard, or if Merlin picked up the species. And all that information gets put into a database that I maintain. And then we also upload all of it to eBird so that it can be used by scientists and researchers. to kind of study bird populations as well.
Nice. And how have you noticed the winter weather affect your weekly bird counts in any way?
Yeah, so that's kind of the cool part. We've been doing this for a little over 2 years now. So we've got some comparable, you know, trends that we can see from year to year, which is pretty cool. We're able to notice, you know, seasonality wise, like we've been getting, you get different species during, you know, depending on what time of year it is. We also have noticed, like, depending on if they're doing any kind of maintenance, that impacts, like, what species we're seeing in certain areas, that kind of stuff, which is really cool. And it's helpful for us because then we can inform ground staff, hey, this is what we're seeing, like, this is how it's impacting, like, you know, the biodiversity of the area, that kind of stuff. And so we can kind of open up a conversation and kind of have that dialogue about conservation impacts, too.
I know the Milwaukee County Zoo also opened a backyard bird walk exhibit last year. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
So it's a pretty cool exhibit. I recommend next time you're visiting the zoo to come and take a peek at it. It's really nice in the summer. It's got a bunch of picnic tables, benches, that kind of stuff. But essentially what it is it's an area to learn about bird conservation. So we've got a bunch of different sections of the bird walk. So the first section, you've got a bunch of different types of nest boxes, things that you can actually even put up in your own yard if you would like to. We've got an entire section dedicated to bird feeders. So it's got just about every single kind of bird feeder that you could possibly imagine in that section and explaining what species are attracted to what kind of feeder. We've also got a section dedicated to bird strikes. So it's a giant window display that shows all these different options of things that you can put on your windows at home to help prevent bird strikes because they are a significant killer of birds, unfortunately. But it's a really cool just way to learn about conservation and how you can help conserve stuff in your backyard. And we've got a ton of native plants planted back there, too. So it's beautiful, absolutely beautiful in the summer. I highly recommend it.
Yeah, I'll definitely have to visit. And I'm listening to you talk, and I know we just kind of touched on this, but for some people who are listening, how does this wild birds program go hand in hand with what the zoo's doing?
Yeah, so it all contributes to conservation work, right? Honestly, what we're doing is we're studying the property, what we're doing here in our own home. Because even though we participate in all of this global conservation work, because we have a lot of, you know, global species here as part of our collection, it's also really important to conserve what we have here. And our zoo is one of the few zoos that really doesn't have a whole lot of developed areas. We've got a lot of wooded areas on the zoo property, which is really, really cool. It's something that people really love about our zoo. It's one of the biggest features that people say that they enjoy. And so we kind of have something special here and kind of taking a look at what we have and how we can help support the species that are calling this place home. Because even though we've got, you know, the animals in our collection, it's important to take care of what we have here, too.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Yeah.
So, you know, at the end of every Chirp Chat, I love for guests to shine a spotlight on a bird for the month.
Sure.
I'm so sorry to put you on the spot. I know it's really hard, but what's a bird you'd like to highlight this month?
I'm a woodpecker guy. I really like red-bellied woodpeckers.
Yeah, talk about them.
Yeah, yeah. So they really don't have a lot of red on their belly, but there's already a red-headed woodpecker, so they can't call them red-headed woodpeckers. Mm-hmm. But they have a nice red patch on the back of their head. They've got the nice gradient black and white speckling on their backside. And they're just really funny. They're charismatic. I oftentimes will find them, you know, hopping around the tree, squawking at me. Sometimes when I'm filling feeders, there'll be one sitting in the tree, like, squawking at me because he knows I'm filling the feeder and he wants to get in first dibs. they're just very charismatic. Woodpeckers are just a lot of fun, I find. They make some really interesting calls, too. So.
Yeah. Does a red belly make an interesting call in any way?
Yeah, I feel like almost every woodpecker species sounds like it's laughing. Like, that's what I always feel like their calls sound like, at least, like, the longer versions of their calls. It kind of just sounds like they're having a chuckle, and you know, downy, hairy, red-bellied, northern flickers, they all have a little bit of a different laugh, just like people. So I think that that's a lot of fun to watch out for, too.
Yeah, I love that. Thanks for sharing that with me. Mm-hmm. Well, Toby, I really appreciate you for speaking with me today and helping me learn how to take care of birds this winter.
Yeah, for sure. Happy to help.
Toby Siegert is the Regional Conservation Specialist for the Zoological Society of Milwaukee. He spoke with LegFX expert Nunez in November for our series Chirp Chat. New episodes begin next month. A new season of Bulber Talk is also on the way, and we need some new questions. Submit your questions about the Milwaukee area at WUWM.com. We'll take one more break and then find out if getting a real or fake Christmas tree is better for the environment in the long run. Keep listening to Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. This is Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. While we finally got some snow to brighten up our Wisconsin winter, people may still have some Christmas decorations up to keep their homes cozy and festive in these dreary cold months. There's certainly nothing wrong with that, but if you still have a natural tree in your home, we are coming up on the deadline for city curbside pickup for those trees. Each year, getting a fresh tree is part of a holiday tradition. But is getting a new tree every year more environmentally friendly compared to reusing a fake one? To help us break down what is best for Wisconsinites, I'm joined by Stefan Schnitzer, a professor of ecology at Marquette University. Stefan, welcome to Lake Effect.
Audrey, thank you for inviting me. It's a pleasure to be here.
So when it comes to Christmas trees and other evergreen decorations for the winter season, which is better for the environment, a real or a fake tree?
The choice of whether to get an artificial tree or a real tree, if you're a Wisconsin resident in particular, is easy if you're thinking about the environment. It's a real tree. Getting a real tree is good for the environment. You're supporting tree farms that are planting lots of trees, which are pulling carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere. And it's a sustainable resource. We cut them down every year, but they're replanting three or four to each one they cut down. And so they have a stock of trees that are growing each year. And so that is definitely the environmental choice. The artificial tree, on the other hand, is made from petroleum and metal, basically. They have a metal spine, and plastic is made out of petroleum. It goes into the landfill when you eventually throw it away, and you can't recycle it. It's unrecyclable. Whereas the real tree, you can compost that, and the city has a compost program, and they'll come to your curb and collect your tree.
Now, before we get into some of the details of disposing of our trees properly, you mentioned the plastic trees, and the word is right in the title, right? Fake Christmas tree. In addition to what it's made of, what other factors contribute to these trees being bad for the environment?
Well, almost all of the artificial trees that we buy are made in China, so they have to be shipped across the ocean and then trucked to the store where you purchased it. So that's a big environmental cost. And the local trees also have to be shipped to a lot, or you have to drive up to a Christmas tree farm, but it's a lot closer. It's less of an impact.
Yeah, let's get into how local harvesting works. So say there is a lot, so we're here in Milwaukee, so say there's a Christmas tree sale at your local church parking lot, you know, a few weekends leading up to Christmas. How does this ecosystem work? How does harvesting a Christmas tree support local forests and local businesses?
Well, there is a lot of Christmas tree farms in Wisconsin. So if we were in a different state, we may be having a slightly different conversation. But in Wisconsin, there's a lot of Christmas tree farms. These are nice local businesses. They're planting trees. It's good for the environment. It's good for wildlife. And they're harvesting part of their Christmas tree crop, and they're bringing them to sell at lots. Or they offer a cut your own tree, or you can go there and they'll cut it for you. And so it's a local business that's nice to support because it's very ecological and environmental.
You mentioned about three trees are planted for every one cut down. What is the typical land management style that tree farms follow? Are there any other practices that make it the best choice, or is pretty well established that this is good for not just their business, but for the land that they're working on?
Yeah, that's a good question. I'm sure that different tree farms use slightly different techniques on how many they plant and how many they maintain. they don't want them to get too big, otherwise it just becomes a forest, right? They can't really use those trees for their business, but they're planting extra trees because some of the trees may get sick or some of the trees may die, or they just may need a gradient of tree sizes. They want some small ones, they want some medium ones, and they want some big ones. But having a real tree that you caught versus an artificial tree aren't the only two choices. There are also trees, smaller trees in pots that some people purchase, and then they plant them in their neighbor's yard in the middle of the night. No, I'm kidding about that. You can then plant those trees afterwards if you have land or if you have a place where it's allowable to plant trees.
And with Wisconsin being such a good state for local tree farms, are there any biodiversity concerns when it comes to all the evergreens and types of evergreens that are planted here? Or is our state pretty hospitable and habitable for these kind of breeds?
Yeah, it's a very good question, Audrey. It's hard to answer. Yes, it's not good to plant a monoculture plantations. And so that's not ideal, but it's better than an old field, right? I mean, you're still adding trees to the environment. You're still supporting wildlife. A diverse forest would be better. That's without question. But in contrast to agriculture, Christmas tree farms are a plus for the environment. They're not the ideal, but they're still a plus.
Yeah, still a natural ecosystem taking up land versus a business or something else in an empty field.
Yeah, and they're not clearing extensively. They're planting the trees. They're giving them a little room and letting them grow, and the trees are fine. And so they don't have to manage every little piece of the land around the tree. So you have some natural regeneration coming up around the trees, just as long as the trees are getting light and growing.
All right. So, you know, we're a bit later in the season, but I've seen a lot of decorations still up, a lot of trees still up. So some people might not be ready to get rid of their Christmas tree yet, but say they are. What is the next step when we're ready to dispose of a natural tree?
Well, when you're ready to dispose of a tree, a natural tree, you have to remove all of the ornaments and decoration, and then you can call the city and you put the tree by the curb. And you call the city, their number is 414-286-CITY, and you tell them that you would like to have a tree picked up, and they'll come and pick it up. And what they do with these trees is they shred them and compost them, and then people can use the wood chips or eventually the soil. But that's only up until January 31st. So the city composts and recycles these trees from December 26th until January 31st.
Okay, so people have a little bit of time, but now is the crunch time to actually take down those Christmas decorations if people have been delaying it a little bit. But say, you know, you don't necessarily want it to be mulched and composted. Are there any other nice alternatives for people who want to just simply have their tree but in an outdoor space? Is there a benefit to letting it just, say, be outside in your own yard?
Oh, sure. You can plant these trees. So when you cut a tree, basically, when you bring your Christmas tree home, a live tree, you'll want to recut the stem and then put it in water right away. That will help the tree absorb water. You have a little stand that you have to buy for the tree. You fill it with water. The tree actually will move a lot of water, so you have to water these things every day or every other day if they're inside. It's usually very dry, so they're using a lot of water. And some of these you can plant, but most of them you're going to want to compost in some way. You can do that in your yard if you have enough room. Artificial trees, well, those you have to store in your basement. And if you have an artificial tree, which a lot of people do because they're cheaper over the long run, if you use an artificial tree for, I think that I've read anywhere from 5 to 10 years, well, then you're actually starting to reduce your environmental impact of that tree, right? So if you do have an artificial tree, you shouldn't immediately throw it away and start buying real trees. You can still use it. The best thing to do is to keep using it year after year after year until it no longer functions. And then you can throw it away. And I would suggest buying a real tree, but there are some drawbacks to having real trees. They're a bit more expensive. They need water a lot. And you have to be very careful with those trees because if they do dry up, they can be a fire hazard. So you have to be careful, but they are certainly the more environmental option.
Especially here in Wisconsin.
That's right. That's right. Especially here in Wisconsin when we have a lot of tree farms.
Well, Stefan, I really appreciate you taking the time to explain the benefits of real versus fake trees.
It's my pleasure.
Stefan Schnitzer is the Director of Environmental Studies and Environmental Science at Marquette University. If you still have a natural Christmas tree in your home, you can still arrange for a city pickup to be shredded and composted by January 31st. Just call 414-286-CITY. And that's Lake Effect for today. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Joy Powers, Sam Woods, and X-Grid Nunez join me in producing Lake Effect each week with help from Rob Larry and Graham Thomas. Becky Mortensen is our executive producer. Emily Files helps edit the show. We also heard from Jimmy Gutierrez and Susan Bentz from the WUWM News team this week. Jason Reavy is our studio engineer. Michelle Maternowski is our digital manager. Valeria Navarro-Viegas is our digital editor. Trapper Shep wrote our theme music. If you've missed any of Lake Effect this week, you can find all of our conversations at WUWM.com. If you'd like to take the show on the go, you can download the Lake Effect podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you so much for joining us today, right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.